you can have a huge variance of how we sit, how we stand, how we move, and it still falls under the umbrella of normal. It's not well-defined, there isn't a gold standard, and it's probably much, much broader than we consider it to be.
How do we define posture? When is it important and how applicable is it to our patients? These are all the things we tackled with Ben Cormack. Now, Ben is working on the Better Clinician project with Adam Meekins. It's a wonderful online course. And today we tackled some specific examples around anterior pelvic tilt. Why does sometimes our interventions seem to help someone? How do we explain that in a BPS model? And more importantly, how might we explain that to our patients? Please enjoy this episode. A lot of practical tips around this ever-evolving subject. My name is Michael Risk, and this is Physio Explained. All right, welcome, Ben, and thank you for joining us again.
Yeah, no, one, it's like a second date. I've been married for so long, I don't even remember what a second date was like, Michael.
I'm more relaxed now, are you?
I'm going to eat my dinner in front of you. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we can get a little weirder on this one.
Let's not get too weird, though.
All right, so we're talking about posture, and just in our online chat, we were going to start with the definitions of posture, because the next question is, are all these arguments about posture in the semantics and in the definition? So if I ask you, Ben, what do you consider posture? What do you run with?
I think classically, when we talk about posture, I think the majority of people are talking about the way we sit or the way we stand. You know, that classical back straight, shoulders back, chin tucked in, what most people would say, that's good posture.
Yeah.
You know, I think for me and for most people, that's really what it boils down to.
I agree. And there's probably something in that old narrative of we have to sit up straight, what we were taught at school. And I guess a lot of the beef online is around, are some physios or health professionals still sharing that message that you have to sit up straight? What's your experience been with that?
I think so much of what we do is unclear and hard to navigate. So how many times do you have someone come in and their signs and their symptoms and their assessments are just all over the place, you know? All the patterns that you learned at university do not apply here, right? So I think what happens is it's very, very easy to say that's the problem. It's very, very easy to say, you know, oh, your shoulder problem, it's probably bad posture. And I think half the time people don't even measure or look or any of it. It's just a go-to explanation to start to give someone a bit of a reason, a bit of an answer. It's a clinical shortcut, isn't it? I get it.
Yeah.
You know, the world is unsure and it's easy to say, oh, it's probably your posture or it's this muscle or it's that muscle. And it's a cognitive shortcut, but it maybe that isn't always the truth.
That's true. And so let's talk about posture and pain, because my understanding, not having read the individual papers deliberately, but my understanding is that the correlation between posture and pain is either little or non-existent. Do you have any views there or readings on that?
Well, certainly there's not many good papers or well-done papers that I've seen that create a clear link between the two. And I don't know of any papers that have actually successfully changed posture and changed pain and looked at the correlation between those two factors. We often get an exercise program aimed at changing posture, and it can often have a really good effect on pain, but the old stretch and strengthen doesn't actually change the posture. And we've seen that around the scapula, and we've seen it around the lumbar spine and various other places. I think the big problem we have here is that when we talk about posture and look at posture, we expect it to have this really, really tight distribution around this middle. If you imagine like a bell curve, and it's really tight around this median of or middle of good posture. Now, what I think we need to understand about human function, going even beyond posture, is that that bell curve is probably really, really, really broad. You know, it's much, yeah, much wider than, you know, normal is not very tightly distributed, I think. Normal is very, very broad. And what's normal is just so big. And we expect it to be this like pinpoint accurate, well-defined thing. And I think posture is a really, really good example of that, that you can have a huge variance of how we sit, how we stand, how we move, and it still falls under the umbrella of normal. It's not well defined. There isn't a gold standard, and it's probably much, much broader than we consider it to be.
I guess that's where the online discussions keep raging. I want you to pull me up on this, Ben, because I've been involved in some of these conversations, and maybe I'm pull me up on all my strawmans and incorrect arguments here. But something I was trying to get across was, if I sit in complete thoracic kyphosis from my 20s to my 40s, I'm going to be that middle-aged man who now doesn't have any thoracic extension. I get stuck in that position. And then when I try to go into shoulder flexion, I lose my thoracic extension. So now I'm just running out of room. And in those steps, I was explaining, well, posture is important now because that posture I've sat in and maybe could have done something about is now restricting my functional movement or my shoulder flexion. And potentially, is that a cause of pain? Can you pull me up on every step of those points and where I could be incorrect?
Yeah, well, firstly, you're expecting far too much reliability in human function there. Again, we are not machines. You've explained these nice, intuitive, mechanical steps that occur, right? And we measure that biomechanically, don't we? But this is the problem, isn't it? Is that we have this idea of how the body biomechanically functions, but one of the definitions of biology is variance. And that might be variance in the way that we move, the way that we look, the way that we function, the way that we respond. So I think that's part of the problem, is that ideologically, if you think about the body as a mechanical thing, then it's going to behave in this reliable, consistent, mechanical way where X does Y, Y does G, G does X. And then I get a result. Same way I turn the engine of my car, petrol floods into the engine, a spark ignites it and physics takes over and chemistry takes over and creates this operation. Problem is we're not cars. We are this wonderful biological organism that operates in these local and global ways, complexity, dynamical systems, complex systems interacting with each other in non-linear ways. And really what that means is we don't operate in this simple, mechanically intuitive sense. So one person may be hugely affected by 10 minutes of sitting. Another person may be unaffected by 40 years of sitting.
Yeah.
And again, it's that huge variance, isn't it, of that biological organism. It's just not as simple as it's made out. So I get it. The foot pronates, the tibia falls in, the femur follows it, the pelvis does it. Rah, 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 rah. But when we study these things, actually, we find out that sometimes it does the opposite and it doesn't make a difference. Here's a great example, roll and glide, right? Do you remember learning about roll and glide? So the joints, the arthrokinematics, all of these different things. When we study it, we find out sometimes it does exactly the opposite. You know why? Because we are not machines, and it's the paradigm that we understand the body in, that we want to analyze biomechanically, but we have to realize it's the biology that's important here. We're not machines. And if we're not machines, we are not going to operate in a simple, mechanistically linear way. We're going to do lots and lots of different things, and that's still normal.
Want to take your physio skills to the next level? Look no further than our masterclass video lectures from world-leading experts. With over 100 hours of video content and a new class added every month, Masterclass is the fastest way to build your clinical skills, provide better patient care, and tick off your CPD or CEUs. Click the link in the show notes to try Physio Network's masterclasses for free today.
That's a beautiful explanation. I guess how I interpret that is, in that example, someone might sit at the desk for 40 years and not lose thoracic extension. And someone might sit at the desk for 40 years and lose thoracic extension, but not lose shoulder flexion because they find another way. And someone might sit at the desk for 40 years, lose shoulder flexion, but have no pain. And someone might be in the same position and have lots of pain. And you could at never one of those points say that that was the cause of the pain. That's how I interpret what you said.
Yeah, sort of. I think the best thing is that could we come up with a million different alternatives there? Hmm. You think of all the variables that are occurring, because again, we're trying to isolate two variables here, aren't we? And create this causative link with this mechanistic rationale. So what about something like a social determinant of health? What about whether this person's happy or sad? What about their sensitivity levels? What about their heritability? What about epigenetics? What about all the other stuff that also is having an influence there? Again, it's a very, very simple, mechanistically linear story, but it doesn't represent the absolute a million amount of variables. Let's take back pain, for example. Let's forget the shoulder example. This person sat there. They've gone into an anterior pelvic tilt. Obviously, at some point, that's going to kill them. You know, it's just a ticking time bomb. Right? But if you look at all the things that are associated with lower back pain, is that posture just one part of it? You know, what about comorbidity? What about heritability? What about social determinants? What about psychology? Do you see what I'm saying? It's really a bit of a slap in the face for back pain research, really, isn't it?
It is.
It's like, look at all these billions of dollars we've spent, all this information we have, but it's the way that you sit. Yeah, cheers for that. Thanks.
I think that's a great example. So let's say it is anterior pelvic tilt. And this is what I experience with young health professionals. They see someone with anterior pelvic tilt and they have back pain. And then the health professional, young or old, let's not be ageist, they'll do something that changes the anterior pelvic tilt. Then the person has less pain. So the natural next step is it was the anterior pelvic tilt. How would you explain that to the young health professional who says, no, but Ben, it works. When I see someone who does a squat and they drop into anterior pelvic tilt or they sit in anterior pelvic tilt and they have this compression pain and it goes away, how do you explain that to the young health professional?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things in there, isn't there? I mean, firstly, I think assessing anterior pelvic tilt is deeply unreliable. You know, I remember being taught the old getting down and fiddling around with the knobbles on the pelvis. And again, that's been shown by people like Lee Herrington. And anterior pelvic tilt is the norm, according to some research that we have. The assessment of it is unreliable. So, you know, we may be starting off with a flawed premise to begin with. And it's easy to post hoc fallacy, isn't it? It's easy to say, well, I did X because of Y and got this outcome. And actually, it could be a whole other bunch of reasons. Again, it's kind of simplistic, mechanistic reasoning, I think. And here's the problem about posture. And some of the research really points this out, is that we'll go in, we'll say, oh my God, it's probably because you've got an anterior pelvic tilt. Half the time, people don't assess it. They do something aimed at changing it, but then they don't actually look if it's changed. It's an assumption, isn't it? Anterior pelvic tilt equals tight hip flexors, and therefore it's causing your back pain. Ergo, I'm going to stretch the hip flexors and therefore your pain will go away. But there is a lot of assumption that goes into that. And then people often just go straight to the intervention and then assume that there's a simple link. Whereas actually the premise is not as strong as we first thought.
Yeah, that's the old lower cross syndrome I remember seeing as well.
Yeah, and this has been studied for like the past 50 years, for God's sake.
Yeah, for sure. How I try to explain one part of that is, are we just changing load? Are we giving that person movement options? And is that the thing potentially having some part of the impact on their symptoms?
I don't know if we're, because again, that might be another mechanistic perception. Are we giving options? We don't know. That would depend on if you've assessed options and assessed if options have changed. What we are giving is input.
Yeah.
So we are giving input into a complex nonlinear system. And sometimes that input causes stuff to happen in the black box that we don't always know exactly what's happened. And for some people, that's definitely beneficial. So the only thing I can really think that we can say is we are changing some kind of stimulus. And is that changing that person's response? All the other stuff, I think, is a little mechanistic in rationale.
I like it. So if we are to change someone's posture, we're simply changing one part of the BPS web of determinants, and that one part is just an input, and it may or may not have an impact, and then we'd have to look at the whole other spectrum of things it could be. Is that how you approach it?
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, because I think that we're predicating it on that something's changed mechanistically. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think if you look at all the different potential mediators of why that movement input has changed that person's kind of experience, then I don't know how we determine exactly which one and how and what and why. And again, that's mechanistic rationale, isn't it? And this is where sometimes we struggle, is getting from We do an RCT, for example, and that does create a more of a causative link between the variables being studied, but it actually still doesn't tell us exactly how, does it? You know, there is still that explanatory gap because sometimes we don't always know exactly how these things work. Exercise is a great example. How does exercise change pain, Michael?
Who knows?
Yeah, there you go. I can give you ideas, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah. That's crazy. I feel like the uncertainty is what is getting young health professionals caught up, and they potentially don't like saying, I don't know what caused why. I don't know why your pain got worse or why it got better. How would you approach that as a young health professional if someone comes in and says, I've been told I'm in anterior pelvic tilt?
That's the whole issue, isn't it? I mean, I look at probabilities and options rather than I don't know. So I'm working in a kind of more of a Bayesian inference-based world, and I'm quite comfortable with that now. Maybe that's just getting old, I don't know. And the point here for me is that if someone comes in and they've said, I might say, well, that's a very common reason people are told. We can certainly have a little look and see how that pelvis is moving and functioning, and maybe that will help. What I don't always want to do is I don't want to sow unseeds of certainties in my patients. So I try and avoid the writing reflex. Go, no, it's not your anterior pelvic tilt, because this research in 1972 told me. But I know that I've got to tread this fine line between what this person has been told, what we know, and how I can help. And what I really want to attempt to do is bring those things together. So I talk in, these are things people are commonly told. We could certainly have a look and see how it moves. Maybe we could do some movement in that area and see if it helps. And I think that we have to approach it in a way that's humanistic, not mechanistic, because I think that's where we fall down, don't we? That people are told stuff without anybody's thought for their humanism and their feelings and their thoughts and where that might go. And then I have another clinician who comes along and says, that's wrong. And again, that's not thinking about the person suffering from the problem. So I think the way here is options, probabilities, but ultimately I think it has to be done in a humanistic way that actually considers the patient, not just the evidence. And I think that's most important here.
Ben, that's a wonderful explanation that'll be really helpful for clinicians. So thank you for that. And I want people to check out the Better Clinician Project. If you haven't seen its amazing course that Adam and Ben have put together, some of my practitioners are going through it. And if you're enjoying the content, please subscribe. It helps us get in more ears across the world. Thank you for joining us again, Ben. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, man.